Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 18th of March. Lots of politics in the news over the weekend with CPAC having their convention and a presidential straw poll taking place. Is that at all meaningful? What does it mean that Rand Paul received 25% of the vote? What about Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker? Our guest the first half hour, he hasn't published this yet, but he has said we can ask him about it. Had an interview with Scott Walker, and we'll be talking with him about that. Here's what the lineup is for the hour. John McCormick from the Weekly Standard will be joining us the first half hour, and Joan Walsh from Salon will join us the second half hour. Joan Walsh also looks ahead to 2016, asking the question whether or not Hillary Clinton is too old to be president. There's a lot of news going on this week. The president going to Israel, and we're wondering what the hopes are for the administration, what could be the best possible outcome of that trip. North Korea, posing evidently a nuclear threat to the United States, we're responding on the west coast of this country. How serious is that nuclear threat? We'll be welcoming phone calls on a variety of political issues, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, should you care to leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We start with John McCormick. Hello, John. And a happy belated St. Patrick's Day to you.
Thank you very much. Happy belated St. Patrick's Day to you.
Yeah. You evidently were at the CPAC convention over the weekend.
Yeah, I got to catch a few speeches. I saw Scott Walker speak. I thought it was a pretty strong speech. I was actually pretty impressed, having watched a number of these different governors and senators speak. Walker really seemed to have put some thought into his speech. He delivered it very well. You know, he kind of had some energy, a good cadence, built up to some parts where he got the crowd going. Hadn't really seen that too much because in Wisconsin, you know, he'd do these, when he was campaigning, he'd do these small events because there were so much protests. You'd never really get the opportunity to see him really work over a crowd. I'd watch him talk to, you know, some small groups of, at a plant here, a factory over there. But it was really impressive, I thought, just his ability to kind of give a good and energetic speech and get a crowd going.
I know you haven't published this yet, but perhaps you can give a preview to the people who are listening to in Wisconsin. He's hired a few people to look at this presidential run. Is this going to happen?
Oh, well, obviously, the first big question is 2014. He's got to be reelected governor first. No one's ever lost, really, a governor's race, I think, and gone on to win the presidency 2 years later, although Abraham Lincoln, of course, he lost the Senate race and became president.
Right.
But 2014 is the first thing. I did ask him about 2014, and I think, as everyone's always kind of put, you know, Russ Feingold is kind of the top Democratic candidate in a lot of people's minds, mine at least, and I asked Governor Walker if he thought Russ Feingold was going to run. He said, I don't think so, but I don't know. And he said that he thinks that, you know, Feingold had a chance to run against him in the recall, chose not to, and if he really, you know, wants to run for office again, Walker's hunch is that he'd probably have his heart set on retaking his Senate seat, which is up again in 2014. When's it up? It's up soon. Or there's an open seat coming up soon. And so he thought that he'd run for the Senate when the next opportunity arises.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the presidential race, Walker actually on Friday had an interview in Politico with Jonathan Martin. There's a story right now up at Politico. It's called Walker Opens Up About White House Ambitions. And, he didn't say, I'm definitely running or anything. He said, quote, would I ever be interested? Possibly. I guess the only thing I'd say is I'm not ruling it out, mm-hmm. which, well, that's a lot more than most people say.
Yeah.
And he went on to also say that he wouldn't rule out, you know, leaving midway through his second term to run for the presidency. And the quote was, for me, it's a measure of what I've accomplished and what more I could do to accomplish if I was in a different position. So that's, I mean, for most presidential candidates, you know, they're very candid, almost too coy, I think, about whether they're going to run for president or not. And Walker just says, yeah, I might. I'll see where things stand. And I'm definitely interested. And it's a really intriguing possibility. He'd obviously have a lot of strong competition in 2016, but it's a real possibility, I think.
Let's talk about the results of that presidential primary poll that were taken. Rand Paul, 25% of the votes. Marco Rubio, 23%. Fairly close, but a lot of interest, and I'm wondering why, in Rand Paul.
Well, Rand Paul is very interesting. Obviously, he just had that filibuster last week, which sort of caught the attention of the nation while we had a phony snow day out in D.C. It was actually just raining. And it was impressive. I mean, as a matter of political theatrics, you haven't had a 13-hour talking filibuster in much time, and so long. And Rand Paul also represents a very different strain of thinking in the Republican Party, and that is a much more non-interventionist. Critics would call it isolationist foreign policy. Obviously, the filibuster didn't deal with that necessarily. It was more about civil liberties and whether or not. A drone could be used against a non-combatant in the United States, which I think was a little bit of a little loopy of a question. I don't think that's really a serious issue. The issue at hand was a more serious question. There are deep questions to be asked, but I didn't think that really shed too much, enlightened us very much, but that's just my personal opinion.
Did you get a sense at this convention that the conservative wing of the Republican Party is trying to come up with a new identity for itself? Did they look at the last election and say, we really need to make inroads in attracting a new kind of voter, or we need to change our policy on a subject like immigration?
It depends on who you talk to. I mean, Marco Rubio gave a speech, and he definitely talked about the need to appeal more, to provide a message and a platform that appealed economically to people from across the spectrum, from working class to middle class people, poor. So I think there's definitely that. He didn't talk too much about his immigration proposal. He also kind of rejected. Rubio is obviously kind of the rising star of the Republican Party. A lot of people would say he's got a very good chance of being the Republican nominee in 2016. And he sort of rejected the idea that Republicans needed a wholesale, makeover of their principles, of their fundamental beliefs. He said, we don't need a new idea. Our idea is American. It still works. And that kind of got the crowd going. But he's definitely, though he said that, he's also made it clear he does want sort of he said we need to take our principles and apply them to the challenge of today. And two things he highlighted were student loan debt and health care costs. And while he addressed the problems that need to be solved, it was a very short speech, and it's only 2013, so before he runs for president, I'm sure he'll have to put some more meat on the bones of these policy proposals. But he said those are two policies that conservatives need to find a way to apply their principles and actually solve these problems for everyday Americans. So I think there's definitely a recognition you need to reach out to more people, but there's a question as to what that means. For some people like Rand Paul, it means a different foreign policy. For others, I think it would probably mean any number of issues, but Rubio obviously has this immigration proposal, but he didn't talk about that too much during the conference this weekend.
You did an interview with Marco Rubio in February, and you asked him, would you agree that your thinking on the issue of immigration has changed? If so, when and why did it shift? What answer did you get?
He just said, like most politicians, no, not really. My thinking is I've always been open to this. I think that's not quite accurate, if I can editorialize a bit. I try to just do a straight report, but I covered Marco Rubio pretty closely in 2009, 2010 when he ran for Senate, and he was running against Florida Governor Charlie Crist and wanted to get to his right on every issue. And he was pretty strongly opposed to a path to sedition for illegal immigrants at that time. He's now open to it, and that's fine. I mean, politicians change their mind all the time. President Obama just, he opposed gay marriage in 2008, and then he supported it in 2012. Politicians change their mind for principled and pragmatic, if we can be polite, reasons all the time. So I think this is definitely a shift in Rubio's thinking, but it's been impressive that he hasn't really alienated the conservative base. For this is an issue that nearly tore apart the Republican Party in 2006 and 2007 under George W. Bush, and Rubio's surprisingly gotten a pass from talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin. Not completely, but they haven't, they haven't started railing against him or anything like that. So I think there's definitely a shift in his position, and definitely alienates him from some conservatives who are opposed to any sort of path to citizenship for illegal immigrants. But on the other hand, that puts Marco Rubio exactly in line with the only Republicans who have actually been president in the past 40 years. Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, they were all supporters of immigration reform. And Reagan obviously had that big amnesty in the late 80s.
Switching to the Democrats for a moment, is Hillary Clinton too old to be president?
I don't think so. I think that there's you know, all these advancements in healthcare, as long as she is in good health going into the campaign. I don't think people will think that's too much of an issue. So I think it all depends on how she comes across. If she seems vigorous in 2015, 2016, I don't think it'll be too much of an issue. Just a number these days, I don't think that will matter too much at all.
Did any of the people at CPAC address the threat posed now by North Korea?
You know, I didn't watch every speech. There was definitely a panel on defense issues, and that's an interesting debate right now, where it's more about how much should we be spending on defense policy. So I think that was obviously brought up, but it wasn't really a specific panel on North Korean missile threat. But there was a discussion as to how much we should be spending on the military and whether or not these sequester budget cuts to the Defense Department are too big or just right or not enough.
President is going to Israel this week. What in the mind of the administration would be the best possible outcome of that trip? And what's the purpose, do you think, of that trip?
Well, I think it's his first trip as president over there, so he definitely wants to, work on something. I mean, Iran is a huge issue for Israel. Obviously, they're very much threatened, and President Obama just said that we are Iran is a year away from a nuclear weapon. That was surprising to me to hear that last week. So he said repeatedly that Iran will not get a nuclear weapon. So the question is, what exactly are the action that they're going to take? Could President Obama himself actually decide that it's time to consider a military option, which he's always left on the table? I don't know whether that will be. I'm sure Iran will be the discussion, and I don't know exactly what the administration hopes. Of course, they hope for a non-military solution, but that might be out of reach at this time.
Mm-hmm. So the Republicans in the House have one plan for the budget. The Democrats in the Senate have another plan for the budget. Here we go again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you kind of feel like it's just it's Groundhog Day. You know, you wake up and the exact same things happen.
Exactly.
With the House remaining with the Republicans, the Senate remaining with the Democrats, and President Obama. So it is interesting. I mean, this is the first budget the Democrats and the Senate have introduced in some years. So that's provided a little more debate, but everybody knows that these are just two documents that are never going to be enacted. They're just both parties stating, here are our principles, and then they're going to come together and have some compromise, continuing budget resolution, basically, to keep funding roughly where it is, probably after these sequester budget cuts in place.
Let's go to phone calls. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. John McCormick, our guest, the first half hour of the show from the Weekly Standard. And we start our calls with David from Menominee. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
You know, I watched CPAC this weekend, and I wanted to talk about things that I didn't hear. I didn't hear anything about how we're paying too much for our hospital bills. I didn't hear anything about how we're paying too much for prescription medications. I didn't hear how we're paying too much for fuel and gasoline when the price of oil is far lower than it was under the Bush administration. But I did hear how we want to lower taxes on the extremely wealthy, and they will trickle down money to us, and we've been hearing that for 30 years, and I don't know how long we're going to get hit upside the head with a 2x4 by these guys before we realize who is hurting us, who's taking our money, and what policies are drawing the money out of our pockets while we're being tricked and saying we're going to lower your taxes, which is not a concern of the Republicans to lower my taxes. Their concern is to just not let the government get money.
John.
On those two specific issues, I think a number of people brought up things in terms of bringing the price of fuel down, things like opening up the Keystone Pipeline, opening up federal lands to drilling, to fracking. That's a big new technology to get natural gas and other fuel. In terms of health care costs, yeah, I think that Republicans do need to really flesh out what their alternative is. I mean, people like Paul Ryan have introduced their own bill plans. Marco Rubio, just off the top of my head, I recall him saying that any American should be able to purchase a plan from anywhere in the country. Right now, you have plans. You can only buy them in certain states. So in some states, the state government will say it has to cover everything from acupuncture to who knows what, and that drives up the cost in one state, whereas in another state there are fewer mandates and requirements for what health insurance must cover, and the insurance is cheaper. So that's a longstanding Republican plan. They need to go much farther than that to really address the issue, and there's many issues in terms of medical malpractice abuse, where you have so many doctors who are practicing defensive medicine. They're ordering maybe malpractice isn't so much money, but when it comes to defensive medicine, you've got doctors who are ordering tests for this, that, and the other thing because they're worried about getting sued. So that's a big idea from Republicans, is that you need some sort of medical malpractice reform. And also to sort of just get, everyone should be able to have a tax credit or something to purchase health insurance. Right now you get a tax break to purchase health insurance when you are an employee of a company. But if you're an individual, I was in this position for a while where I didn't get insurance through my employer. I had to go out into, the individual market and purchase my own health insurance. And so I had to pay with that for money after taxes. I didn't get a tax break on that. And Republicans would like to level the playing field and provide everybody with the opportunity to buy health insurance, whether they're an individual or whether they're working at a company.
Doesn't it strike you we've spent years and years talking about health care reform in this country, but we haven't looked sufficiently at the question of why health care in this country costs so much money? It would seem to me as though this could be a bipartisan investigation that would benefit everybody.
It could. There was that, very thorough story in Time magazine,
yes,
5,000 words on this issue. And like I said, I think there are a lot of issues here. I would like to investigate this more. Are we getting better quality? When we compare ourselves to other countries, maybe we're paying more for health care, but are we? I've seen things in some studies, at least, showing that America has better survival rates for a variety of different diseases, a variety of different cancers. There's prostate cancers in some European countries. So I'd really like to look into that to see, are we paying more because we're getting better care, because we have better doctors, because we pay more for the best health care? The crown princes of, in the Middle East are coming to the United States for their health care. They're not going to France or Germany usually. So I'd like to look into that. But obviously, I do think that defensive medicine is a huge part. I talked to Tom Coburn. He's a senator from Oklahoma, and he's an obstetrician gynecologist. And he'll tell you that defensive medicine is just a huge, huge amount of our health care costs, because while the simple payouts in terms of, there's a malpractice lawsuit, a doctor has to pay out this much money to the hospital, but the bigger, like I said, the bigger cost is people ordering all these tests, having all these precautions because they're scared of being sued. And there's many other problems, too. People aren't paying as much for, Medicare insurance, so the costs get shifted on to people who can't afford it. They end up having, and there's no transparency in price, too, So, obviously for some things, you're not going to shop around when you have a heart attack for the best emergency room. But for a lot of other things, a hip replacement, you can't just look at, you should be able to look at, here are 10 different hospitals, here are the different prices, here are reviews and their ratings and whether they're good or not. You don't have that. It's almost like, for some reason, it's medical bills and car prices. It's not listed out there on the internet. You should be able to compare and shop around for a lot of things that you just don't have, I guess. It's a third party payer problem too. Where people don't have the same incentives when the insurance is covering it. You don't have the same incentives necessarily to save money. So if you were to give people the money rather than to just have it through insurance, that would obviously change things. But that would completely upend a lot of ways that people have plan their lives around the current system.
John McCormick, our guest, the first half of All Things Political from the Weekly Standard. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, use that if you'd like, the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this morning, 50 million people in this country, one in four children, do not know where their next meal is coming from. There's a concerted effort. You have probably heard about it earlier today on Joy Cardine's show. She interviewed the author of A Place at the Table, The Crisis of 49 Million Hungry Americans and How to Solve It. There is a documentary film also titled A Place at the Table, and we will be speaking with the filmmaker about hunger in this country and the many, many issues that are on the table. All right, back to phone calls for John McCormick, all things political this hour. What do you think about what we've talked about so far? What do you think about the CPAC convention, Rand Paul getting most votes? What do you think about what our guest said concerning Governor Scott Walker and whether or not he's going to make a run for the presidency? The president going to Israel, that's a big trip, first time he has been there as president. What do you think about that? North Korea and their threat, lines are open for you on all of those issues. Jim in Milwaukee, hello.
Yeah, hi. What I wanted to talk about today is Republican hypocrisy with the subtitle All's Pharisee in Love and War. And in terms of the war situation, of course, the conservatives in the past seem to think that the war is a great thing for your son to fight, but and that we can do it on the cheap. And as it's worked out in terms of all of these budget issues, of course, a war that was originally going to cost $50 to $100 million is, in Iraq alone, has cost us $2 trillion. So that pretty much speaks for itself. And the other issue of love. Of course, we've seen in comparison with Elliot Spitzer and David Vitter that one person is consorts with prostitutes and has to leave government, and another doesn't have to leave and gets to stay, which is in itself hypocritical. And then recently, Senator Portman came out, and while he was running for vice president, or wanted to be considered for vice president, and during the election he didn't say anything about it, but after the election he reveals that his son is gay and now he's in his camp. And Eric Zorn in the Chicago Tribune on Sunday, and also on Bill Maher's show, Rachel Maddow had comments about the hypocrisy of this, because it seems that Republicans only have empathy once one of their own is affected, but other than that, apparently they could care less.
John,
well, a whole lot there to address, I guess. I'll start with the last one. I was a little thought that Senator Portman's reasoning was ridiculous as well. You should be able to think about an issue regardless of whether your son is in a particular situation or whether you have a friend who is gay. You should base your policies on objective truths and whether something's a good idea, not whether someone you know and love, you want something special for them. I think that I changed the other way. When I was in college, I used to not really have a problem with gay marriage. I didn't think there was really much of an issue there. Why shouldn't we address this issue? And the more I thought about it, I just thought, well, you know, I think that the best situation for kids to be raised in is a mother and a father, and we don't really just know whether or not you know, two fathers or two mothers is just as good. So I think it's good to have this institution that we, you know, kind of incentivize and hold up to raise kids. And it also presents a whole host of religious liberty issues, where once you have gay marriage, you're going to be forcing Catholic adoption agencies to place children and I'm not saying that that's all bad or anything. I'm just saying that I think that there's an ideal there objectively, and then there's obviously a religious issue where people are going to, for moral reasons, they're not going to want to be forced in there. That's already happening in Massachusetts. You've had Catholic charities shut down because they've been forced to place children in same-sex couples. And no one's, I don't think that that should be illegal to, you know, I don't think gay adoption should be outlawed or anything, but I think that adoption agencies should be free to place kids where they think is best. And so, yeah, I think that Senator Port, it's not a very easy topic. I mean, a lot of people will look at you and they're very angry and think that you're bigoted and you don't care about people for saying this issue. But if you can just make this argument as non-personal as possible and just trying to think through the issue, I think that's the way you need to take it.
But everything is personal, really, isn't it? Don't a lot of people come to political beliefs because they've been discriminated against, or because they see somebody who's hurting in their own family and they work through the issue personally, and or they've had a healthcare crisis. There are all kinds of personal issues that make people examine policy, public policy.
Exactly. People always personal issues. So on one hand, Senator Portman, it's a very human situation where you really didn't maybe think deeply about an issue until someone close to you was in that situation. I think that the job of a statesman, though, of a senator especially, or anyone who thinks about politics a lot, and the job of all citizens, actually, is to think about things in a more even-handed and objective way, to really to try and say whether is this policy good or not, and well, what if my son were in this situation? I mean, if you support the Iraq War but oppose it because you know your son could be drafted, well, that's not a very good reason. Or if you could think of something different, if you oppose or you favor a tax increase until it would hit you, yeah, that's you shouldn't be so self-interested. You should try and think of things in terms of whether they're objectively good or not. And you know, in terms of personal things, I have lots of friends who disagree with me, and I think that so much, especially, I mean, we saw that with the recall issue where people just took things so personally, where it wasn't simply that there are two people who come at things from a different perspective or have reached a different conclusion on what is good, but that these people are good and these people are bad. I think that people of goodwill all over can have lots of different opinions on really, really important issues, you know, things that I really sincerely believe in, you know, issue of abortion, people, you know, some people say, well, that's a person's choice, and then people like me would say, well, that's you know, it's a human being, and that's taking an innocent life, and you can't do that. But I don't think that people who have or support, you know, our abortion laws or have even had abortions are evil people. I think that abortion is a very, very bad and an evil thing. But I don't think that people can have very different opinions on very important topics and not hate one another or think that the other people are motivated by hate. That's just what I was trying to get at by saying you hope it's not too personal and you can just have a reasonable discussion with people.
John, thanks very much for being with us this half hour.
Thank you, Kathleen.
John McCormick, staff writer for the Weekly Standard, who was at the CPAC convention over the weekend. Joan Walsh is joining us now, editor-at-large at Salon.com, political analyst for MSNBC, and author of What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. Our phone number for Joan, 800-486-8655. She has written recently about whether or not Hillary Clinton is too old to be president, and she's written a great deal about the Voting Rights Act, and we're going to talk about those issues, but I think we may start with Scott Walker and the CPAC convention with Joan and then move on into other issues. Hello, Joan. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. Let's start with Governor Scott Walker because he was making some news over the weekend. He was on Meet the Press, and there is an indication that he might be interested in making a run for the presidency in 2016. What do you think about it?
Well, you know, I think it's a very open field with no clear front runners, and I'm not, you know, I'm a Democrat, so I'm not a big Scott Walker fan, but I think he has as good a chance as a lot of these people. You know, I don't think he's been a particularly good governor, but he comes at it from the perspective of being a governor. I think that's going to be something that's attractive. These ideologues in the Senate, I think, are going to have a harder time. But, you know, I on the other hand, I do think that Scott Walker's defeating the recall went to his head a little bit. He took it, rather than kind of the way I saw it nationally, a referendum on the idea of recall itself, he really seemed as though he thought it validated a lot of his policies and made him a national figure. And I'm not sure that's true. I think it became a national issue. I think that the far right was energized by the opportunity to defeat unions and stand up for a governor who'd taken on unions. But I don't really think it was a mandate for, you know, Scott Walker as a national figure. But, you know, given how open this field is, I think that there are going to be a lot of people like him who say, why not me?
You wrote an interesting piece on Hillary Clinton. I didn't know a lot of people, and maybe it's not a lot of people, but some people are saying she might be too old to be president at the age of 69. What do you say?
Well, I think it's kind of ridiculous. And it came up in a discussion, not even a debate, between me and my friend David Korn. And I don't use my friend ironically. He is my friend, and we tend to agree on most things. But you know, David suggested that, you know, the country has had, you know, Barack Obama for 8 years and is really moving past the baby boomers now. And I thought that was kind of a shocking thing to say. You know, in his defense, Hillary would be one of the oldest people elected were she to be elected. But, you know, I think that to rule her out really damages the Democratic Party because she is, you know, whatever the pundits might say, she's hugely popular. She would be the front runner. And I think it also, there's something, not, I don't want to say sexist as in intentionally dismissive of women, but there's a way in which deciding that, well, you know, at 69, a woman is going to be too old. That idea, whether it's used for men or women, really affects women more because we tend to start a little later, and many of us tend to get a little bit sidetracked by family issues. I'm not saying that's good or bad. That's just factual. And so a woman at 69 might be at a place where she's only had maybe 20 years to really go all out for her career, whereas a man has been doing that since, you know, since he was born. And so I had a very strong reaction to it. And, you know, but I think it will be up for debate.
Mm-hmm. And you think there's little doubt, Joan, that she will be a candidate?
I wouldn't say that, Kathleen. I think there's still some doubt. I would not be shocked if she decided not to run. I think it's more likely that she will run now. I think even, you know, as she was saying her goodbyes and leaving as Secretary of State, I was really tracking the way her denials changed, you know, from perhaps a year earlier saying, oh, I'm not going to do it, I just want to relax and sleep and write and read and da-da-da, to I just don't know what I'm going to do this weekend, or, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do next month, and definitely leaving the door, I think, much more open. And I think, you know, assuming that she does get some rest and is thinking about how, you know, what to do next and her place in history, I think she'll find it very hard to tune out the voices of people, particularly women, who will be saying to her, you are our best shot at having a woman president for a while. I'm not saying there aren't other great women, and I'm not saying it will be forever, but the notion that she is so popular and that the Republican field is so weak, I think will make a lot of women say, you know, please do this. Do it for us. And she might find it hard to say no.
Mm-hmm. I really liked your piece, Joan, on the Voting Rights Act and the Supreme Court looking at Section 5 of this act. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about the issue of voting and restrictions that have been placed on voting in some states. Where do you think, when is the Supreme Court going to issue a decision on this? Is it soon?
I don't think anybody really knows. And you know, today we've got an Arizona case looking at, you know, whether people have to provide, you know, proof of citizenship. And all of these, wherever these take place, they're really designed to diminish voting, first of all. And, you know, obviously, as we've seen in the last few years, to diminish voting among key groups that have gone for Democrats. You know, this has always been a problem, Kathleen, and there have always been, you know, it's why we have a Voting Rights Act, and it's why Section 5, which is the section that deals with states and counties that have a real pernicious history of voter suppression, why they have to present all changes and justify all changes to voting regulations. This problem never went away. It's gotten better in some places, but it's gotten worse in others. And I think, you know, we really saw an amazing renaissance in voter suppression after the 2008 election, where it was clear that the emerging Latino electorate, African Americans, of course, young people, poor people, when they voted, were tending to vote Democratic. And so you saw a wave of attempted restrictions. You know, you saw it in Wisconsin with the limiting early voting and an attempt to end same-day registration, all designed to limit the impact of this rising new electorate, and all coming from Republican leaders. You know, I don't think there's one of these many dozens of restrictions that have been proposed that came from a Democrat. So it's quite partisan, it's quite obvious, and it shows why we need a Voting Rights Act and why we need Section 5.
And yet, this Section 5 really applies to many jurisdictions in the South, doesn't it? It really doesn't cover some of the issues that have been present in northern states.
No, that's true, and that is a problem, and it's a fact that, you know, opponents of Section 5 bring up. But, you know, just because we can't eradicate voter suppression everywhere doesn't mean that we should give up on it where we have a system that's working. But right, I mean, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, lots of states that aren't touched by it, you know, are coming up with these new laws. Arizona is touched by it. States and counties have been added to Section 5 over the years where there's a real clear pattern of attempted disenfranchisement, but, you know, it's not, I don't think that the will exists to cover all 50 states, and I don't know that it's necessary to cover all 50 states, but it certainly is true that it would be unfair to say that the only place that voter suppression is a problem is in the South, because that is not true.
I want to ask you, Joan, about North Korea and the response. It would indicate to me that this government, our current government, is very concerned about a nuclear threat from North Korea, planning new defense systems along the west coast of this country. Please enlighten us on what the heck is going on with this and our response to this growing threat.
Well, I think, you know, I'm not a hawk in any way, but I think that there is a threat, and this, you know, this government is fighting threats and potential threats and the changing nature of threat on so many different fronts. And I think, you know, whether you like it or not, whether you're more of a peace person than President Obama, he's been very very clear and very decisive and very forthright on handling all these threats. It's clear that he is not going to be a Democrat who is who hesitates to step up. He's handled Iran certainly reasonably well and with reasonable restraint, given the constant drumbeat of hawkishness from the right, as though it would be a good thing for us to get involved in another war. But, you know, I think North Korea has been and remains very unpredictable and something that we have to worry about. But, you know, on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War, I would like to hear more people really focusing on, you know, peaceful solution of conflict rather than saber rattling, because our current even as we wind down Iraq, we're still too involved in too many places at too much cost to this country.
Joan Walsh, our guest, this part of All Things Political, and we're welcoming phone calls for her. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email for a message for Joan is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Joan is editor-at-large for Salon.com. You see her if you watch MSNBC frequently. She's a political analyst, and she's the author of What's the Matter with White People? More phone calls in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, we ask, why are there more than 50 million people in this country food insecure? They don't know where their next meal is coming from. Why do we seem to have a handle on this problem back in the 1970s, but we sure don't now? Our guest is filmmaker Christy Jacobson, who talks about her latest film project that tackles the issue of hunger in America. Christy is the documentarian of A Place at the Table. You probably heard Joy Cardine earlier this day. I hope you did. She interviewed the author of A Place at the Table. So it's a concerted effort on the part of documentarians and people writing books and people who are concerned about this issue to take it on and put it in the public's awareness through a huge multimedia campaign. So that's hour two of our show. All right, let's go to phone calls. Barb in Sister Bay is our first caller for you, Joan. Hi, Barb.
Hi, thanks for the great show. I just wanted to tell Joan Walsh congratulations on saying that about Hillary Clinton not being too old, but I wanted to remind people that some of the worst vitriol from the 2008 campaign came from left-wing columnists at The Nation and at places like Daily Kos. And I think she's being a bit tepid in not saying that with a little bit more strength behind it. And that's my comment.
Thank you, Barb.
Oh, I remember that well. I was in lots of debates with my friends on the left who were, dismissive and derisive of Hillary Clinton and, anointed Barack Obama the one true progressive hope. A lot of those people would later admit they were wrong and have become some of Hillary's great defenders. But 2008 was, there was a lot of ugliness in that race, and I was certainly somebody out there fighting it on Hillary's behalf.
Thank you, Barb. Steve in Madison, hi.
Yeah, and I, on the other hand, wondering how long before the flock of sheep known as mainstream media are going to shift from recommendation of Hillary to considering Michelle Obama as a decent presidential candidate for 2016.
Do you think she would be, Steve?
Absolutely.
Joan?
For a number of reasons, including that she's going to represent the next generation of consciousness in the United States.
Joan?
Well, I love Michelle Obama, and I think she would be a great leader. I think that, she would probably be the first to say that moving from First Lady directly into the Oval Office would be quite a leap. And, I think that those of us who admire her, I'd be thrilled to see her have a political career. I think that would be that might not be the best first step for her.
Thanks, Steve, very much for the call. Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I just wanted to say about Governor Scott Walker, I think after what he's done to our state, I don't really think that he would stand up to the national press. But the first guest talked about the XL pipeline and Keystone XL pipeline, and they keep saying that it's going to affect prices at the pump. And, I sometimes think they must think we're, the Republican strategists or whoever is proposing this must think we're idiots, because the oil goes into, in the first place, is Canadian oil, and it goes into the world market. It's not our oil. If it was our oil, that would be communism. So it's a world-traded market. Speculators drive up the price. The price of diesel has not dropped for more than a year. And also what's involved in this wonderful fracking technology is the use of very nasty chemicals rammed down into the earth under high pressure, plus it includes flattening out large parts of Wisconsin with, removing whole ridges and hills, which is happening about 4 miles from where I live. We're in a place called Cook's Valley. There are all these mines that are, they all have high-capacity wells, and they all use diesel fuel to transport the sand. And it's not a winning strategy, I think, to double down on the very problem.
June.
Well, William is right. I mean, it's really a bait and switch here. They talk about it as helping to lead to energy independence, and they talk about it as bringing down prices. But, all of the documents show that very, very, very little of the gas, if any at all, will wind up here, and that it is all intended for world markets. So, he's absolutely right about this, and yet Republicans think we're not paying attention and that they can sell it as an answer, as a part of energy independence, which they know is a popular notion in this country.
Thanks, Willem, for the call. Let's talk about health care for a moment, Joan, and the Affordable Care Act, which is going to be here before we know it. We did a show on this last week, and I got to tell you, we were flooded. I mean, flooded. We get a lot of calls on this show, but
yeah.
Email messages and phone calls, and people aren't sure what's happening, and they don't know where to go for information. It's a little worrisome. Do you think that we need a little more education on affordable health care? Do you think that people will like this program once it's in full measure, or they won't like it, and there will be more of a move to, it's hard to believe that there's a call for repealing Obamacare again, which probably isn't going anywhere, but will more people say, all right, let's get rid of it before we even start it?
Right.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think that there's any serious chance that it will be repealed. But I think, you know, what we've seen all along, Kathleen, is that some elements of it are very popular, as well they should be. You know, keeping kids on parents' insurance till they're 26, a lot more preventive services without copay, contraception without copay. All of that is great. What we haven't seen yet is what the impact is going to be on the price of private plans, and you know, in states where there's a strong regulatory system, it's possible that private insurance companies' plans to raise rates either because of Obamacare or using it as an excuse. Those states with strong regulators are able to hold the line on those increases. Other states may not be able to hold the line, and if people's costs do go up, that's going to make it less possible. I think, you know, those of us who always wanted there to be some kind of public option to compete with the private insurance companies, you know, I assume that we're going to have... I will not be happy to say we told you so, but I assume we're going to have... A we told you so moment, as there's great volatility in pricing, and you know, as always, and this isn't a criticism of the Obama administration. It's just sort of the nature of public policy. But I do think that we're going to find that there should have been, and there will need to be, a much more aggressive public education campaign, because people. Anything that goes wrong will be blamed on Obamacare, regardless of whether it has anything to do with it at all. And so for political reasons as well as policy reasons, I think they really need to get out in front of this. And it may be too late to get out in front, but at least begin to meet some of the demand for information and fight some of the confusion.
And do you think, Joan, we will in America ever have a public option?
I do think we will. I don't know when, but I think this experiment will probably push us there. I think, you know, as people look at Medicare and how much, you know, costs are going up, yes, but Medicare is really efficient compared to private insurance, and there are lots of reasons why. You know, they really can negotiate with doctors. They need to be able to negotiate with drug companies more. And having, you know, more people in the Medicare system would make it cheaper, frankly. You know, we hear these calls from the right to raise the age of eligibility, but in fact what we should be doing is bringing it down by 5 years and getting that pool of younger, healthier people, pre-seniors in there with their premiums to bring, you know, to spread the risk better, but also to give that cohort of people more preventive care. You know, part of the problem with Medicare, and what would really be a problem if we raised the age, is that you do have seniors and people who aren't quite seniors who postpone all self-care, all preventive care, until they get Medicare.
Yes,
and that's
when, yes.
You know, we discover that they have, you know, terrible illnesses, chronic illnesses, terminal illnesses that cost an enormous amount of money. And if we brought those people into the system at 55 or 60, I think they'd be healthier and we'd be spending less money. So I think we're beginning an experiment that's going to lead in that direction, but politically it's tough going.
Isn't it amazing that we've spent all these years talking about this healthcare issue, I mean, in great detail, and yet we still don't have a handle on why it costs so much? I mean, we understand it, but we don't want to do anything about it.
We don't want to do anything about it. No, we really don't want to stand up to the forces that, you know, that are making a big profit from it being this way. And I think that, you know, if we could put much more emphasis on prevention, there's so many common sense things we can do. And yet, you know, the extreme right screams, you know, death panels and nanny state and at anything, you know, including, to go back to Michelle Obama, you know, including her efforts to just simply get people to move around more and eat more healthy food. You know, that is, you know, socialism and an intrusion into our lives, if you listen to, you know, the folks at CPAC and elsewhere. So.
Joan Walsh, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me again, Kathleen.
Our pleasure. Joan Walsh, editor-at-large of Salon.com. She's a political analyst you see frequently on MSNBC, and her latest book is What's the Matter with White People? We also thank John McCormick, staff writer for the Weekly Standard, for joining us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks for all of your calls. We sometimes like to continue the conversation. So if you want to go to Facebook and leave messages about what you thought were the big stories of last week and going into this week, we would love to hear from you. I kind of like Facebook. And the place to go is the Kathleen Dunn Show. News ahead, and we will continue. We are talking about hunger in America this hour. Joy Cardine did earlier today. We will as well in just a little while.